The captain went through the motions of setting up a guard mount, but it was a futile effort. Most of these suffering men could do little to defend themselves should the Indians choose this time to attack. Gideon's vision was so blurred that he couldn't have drawn a bead. Sergeant Nettles could no longer control his limp. He kept his eyes on the captain and contrived not to move more than necessary when the captain looked in his direction.
Sergeant, why don't you take your rest?
You're trying to tell me what to do, Private Ledbetter?
No, sir. It just come to me that you had a hard day.
We all had a hard day. Mine ain't been worse than anybody else's.
You rode back and forth, walked back and forth, seeing after the men. You gone twice as far as most of us. You rest, why don't you? Tell me what you want done, and I'll do it.
I want you to leave me alone. Ain't nothing wrong with me that ain't wrong with everybody here.
The rest of them got no arrow wound that ain't ever healed up.
The anger in Nettle's eyes turned to sharp concern.
It's all right, and I don't want you talking about it.
He glanced quickly toward the captain and showed relief to find Hollander's attention focused elsewhere.
You've been hiding it from him.
He could not remember that he had ever seen Nettle show fear of anything, but the sergeant was fearful now. He gripped Gideon's arm.
Don't you be telling him. Don't be telling nobody. Without the army, what could I be, Where could I go?
Lots of things. Lots of places.
Now, you know better than that. In the army, I'm a sergeant. A top sergeant. I'm somebody, and I can do something. Anywhere else, I'm just another nigger.
Captain will see for himself sooner or later.
Not as long as I can move. Now, you get to your own business.
Sometime during the early part of the evening, Gideon heard horses walking. He pushed up from the ground, listening, hoping it was Jimbo and the canteen carriers coming back. He was momentarily disoriented, dizzy, but he realized the sound was from the wrong direction to be Jimbo. It was coming from along the column's back trail to the west. He thought about Indians, but they wouldn't make that much noise. The clinking and clanking meant cavalry horses. Captain Hollander figured it out ahead of Gideon. He walked to the edge of the camp and did his best to shout.
Waters! Sergeant Waters, up here!
The riders continued to move, passing the hill and going on eastward. The captain clenched his fists in anger.
I'll go, sir. I'll fetch him back.
Gideon took that for approval. He started down the hill, his legs heavy.
Waters!
When he stopped to listen, he could tell that the horses were getting farther from him.
Waters!
He tried to run, but could not bring his legs to move that rapidly. He stumbled over the crown of some dried-up bunch grass and sprawled on his belly. He invested a strong effort into getting on his feet.
Come back, Ledbetter! Let him go!
He wavered on the point of insubordination, but found he could barely hear the horses anymore. He had no chance to catch them. Wearily, he turned and began the struggle back up the hill. It must have taken him an hour to reach the huddled company and fall to the ground. Hollander stood over him against the starlight.
You tried.
They just never did hear me.
They heard you. Waters simply did not choose to stop. He's saving himself. Or trying to.
Nettles came over after a while to see if he was all right.
What's the matter with Sergeant Waters? I know you heard me. I never figured him to panic out of his head.
I seen him when the men commenced to groan. Now, he was the groaning done it. Now, you ever wonder why he drank so much? It was to drive the groaning sounds out of his mind.
I don't understand.
Old days, Waters was a slave catcher. Now, it was him that kept the hounds, and him the white folks give the whip to when he caught a runaway. Now, he didn't have no choice. They'd have took the whip to him if he hadn't done it. Now and again, they made him keep whipping a man till the life and the soul was beat out of him. I reckon them dead people been coming after Waters ever since in his mind.
The morning sun was soon punishingly hot. Miles went by slowly and painfully, and Jimbo did not come. Far up into the morning, after a couple of troopers had slumped to the ground, Hollander called for a rest stop. They moved into a sandy stretch of ground with low-growing, stemmy mesquite trees and small oak growth shin to knee-high. Many of the men draped blankets over these plants and crawled under them as far as they could go for partial protection against the punishing sun. Hollander was somehow still able to articulate, though he spoke his words slowly and carefully.
In my judgment, Jose is lost and won't be coming back. Not today, not ever. The same goes for the men who followed after him with the canteens.
Well, somewhere ahead lies Silver Lake, and that is no doubt Jose's goal. He can't be more than a few miles, 15 or 20 at most.
Hollander shook his head violently, his face flushed.
If water were that near and Jose had found it, Jimbo and the others would be back by now.
The captain pointed southeastward. He still had his compass. Water anywhere else was a guess, and evidently a bad one.
I know there is water in the Double Lakes. It's time to stop gambling and go for the cinch.
What, do you know how far it is to the Double Lakes? Those darkies of yours are almost dead now. They'll never live for another 60, 70 miles.
They'll live. They've got to live.
Water lies much closer, to the northeast.
You said that yesterday. How far have we come? How many more men can we afford to lose?
Thompson pointed his chin across the sandy hills toward Double Lakes.
You go that way and you'll lose them all.
There is water at Double Lakes. There's only death out here in these sands. You go with us.
Thompson turned and studied his hunters.
No, we're trying for Silver Lake. It's there. I know it's there. I beg you, Captain, come on with us.
But Hollander had made up his mind.
I've already gambled and lost. I'll gamble no more on water that may not exist. Best of luck to you, Thompson.
The buffalo hunter saw the futility of further argument.
God go with you, Frank.
Hollander nodded.
May he walk with us all.
Anger stood like a wall between the men, but each managed to thrust a hand forward. The two groups parted, the hunters toward the hope of Silver Lake and a short trail, the soldiers toward the certainty of Double Lakes, a long and terrible distance away. The last time Gideon glimpsed the hunters, fading out of sight far to his left, four were walking, the rest hunched on their horses. Though he had not become personally acquainted and could not have named any except Thompson, he felt an ache of regret, a sense of loss, as they disappeared into the shimmering heat. He had no feeling for time. His legs were dead weights that dragged along one step and another. His vision blurred again. He trudged with his head down, following the tracks of the men in front of him. He no longer thought ahead, or even thought much at all. He fell into a merciful state of half-consciousness, moving his body by reflex and instinct. His tongue had swollen so that it almost filled his mouth. At times, he felt he would choke on it. He was conscious of hunger, but unable to act upon it. He put hardtack into his mouth, but could not work up saliva to soften it. It was like dry gravel against his inflexible tongue. He had to dig the pieces out with his finger. Rarely did the horses or mules urinate, but when they did, someone rushed in with a cup. The thought was no longer revolting to Gideon. Captain Hollander passed down brown sugar for the men to stir into the urine and increase its palatability. Some was given back to the horses, which at first refused, but later accepted it. By mid-afternoon, when the heat was at full fury, the horse staggered and went down. Hollander cut its throat to put it out of its misery. Finley came with his cup and caught the gushing blood and drank it, and others took what they could catch before death overtook the animal and the flow stopped. Some of the men became violently ill. The blood was thick and bitter from the horse's dehydration.
Halt! We'll rest here until the sun sets.
Men were strung out for half a mile. Orders meant next to nothing. This was no longer a column of soldiers. It was a loose and straggling collection of half-delirious men struggling for individual survival. Gideon lapsed into a dreamlike state and seemed to float away, like some bodiless spirit, back to the plantation. He heard the happy voice of Big Ella and the others there, and he splashed barefoot in the cool, flowing river. The heat abated with sundown, and night brought a coolness which broke Gideon's fever. Sometime in the night, Captain Hollander started trying to get the men to their feet to use the cooler hours for easier miles. Gideon watched him impassively at first, until the man's strong determination began to reach him. Sergeant Nettles arose and began limping from one man to another. Gideon pushed to his feet and helped.
Good man, Ledbetter. Get him going.
Nettles asked Gideon to count the men to be sure they left none behind. He found it difficult to hold the figures in his head. His mind kept drifting to other things. Many blankets and packs were left on the ground as the company moved out. A couple of men dropped their carbines, and Gideon forcibly put them back in their hands. A little later, he looked back and saw that one of the men was empty-handed again. He dreaded sunrise, but it came. He sensed that they had walked or ridden many miles in the cool darkness. The heat was blunted the first couple of hours by a thin cover of dry clouds that held no promise of rain. These burned away after a time. The men and horses trudged under the full punishment of an unforgiving July sun. A staggering horse brought the procession to a halt. Without waiting for the captain to give an order, one of the troopers cut the animal's throat, and several fought over the gushing blood. Gideon saw Nettles start toward the men to break up the fight, then go to his knees. Nettles sat helplessly. The spirit was still strong in his black eyes, but the flesh had gone as far as it could. Gideon managed to get the men under some semblance of control, making gruff noises deep in his throat because he could not force his tongue to form clear words. He felt the eyes of Hollander and Nettles upon him. Without being formally bidden to do so, he took command upon himself and motioned and coaxed and bullied most of the men into movement. Lieutenant Judson, weaving a little, got to his droop-headed horse and took the lead. Soon, only five men were left. Gideon and Hollander on their feet, the sunstruck Nash and shattered little Finley lying on the ground. Sergeant Nettles sitting up, but unable to keep his legs under him. By signs, more than by words, Nettles conveyed his intention of staying with Nash and Finley until they were able to move. Then he would bring them on, following the company's trail to water. Captain Hollander nodded his assent, though Gideon saw sadness in the man's blue eyes. Hollander took the big black hand in both of his own and squeezed it for a moment, silently saying goodbye to an old friend. Hollander turned quickly away, not looking back. Nettles raised his hand again, and Gideon took it. The sergeant mumbled, but Gideon made out the words he was trying to say.
Take care of them, soldier.
Gideon tried to assure him he would be back as soon as they found water, but the words would not come. He turned back only once, 100 yards away, and took a final look at the sergeant, still sitting up, holding the reins of big black Napoleon. For a moment, in spite of the heat, Gideon felt cold. The column moved until upwards of midday, when the heat brought more horses and men to their knees. When Lieutenant Judson went down, slipping from the saddle and landing limply in the dry grass, the column stopped. Hollander tried to rouse Judson, but could not. Hollander slumped to the ground, covering his face with his hands. The lieutenant's horse, untethered, began wandering off southward, dragging the reins, drawn by instinct in the direction of Concho. Gideon knew he should make some effort to bring it back, but he lacked the willpower to move. He sat with his legs stretched out before him on the ground and watched the horse stumble away to a slow death somewhere out there on the parched prairie. After a time, Gideon became aware that the captain was trying to call him. Hollander motioned with his hand. Gideon crawled to the officer on hands and knees. Hollander extended his silver watch, despair in his sunken eyes. Very slowly, very deliberately, he managed a few clear words.
Wife, give to my wife and baby.
Gideon reached for the watch until the import of the captain's words penetrated his fevered brain. Hollander was giving up. Gideon looked slowly around him at the men sprawled on the ground, covering their heads with blankets if they still had them, hats if they did not. If Hollander died, these men would die. Hollander might be no better man than they, but his was the leadership. His was the example they had been conditioned to follow, as they had been conditioned all their lives to follow one white man or another. It came to Gideon that if he accepted the watch, that would release the captain to die in peace. He felt a flare of deep anger. The captain had no right to die. He had brought these men here. He had to live and take them out. Gideon drew back his hand. Shaking his head, he tried to form the words first in his mind, then get them out on his dry, swollen tongue.
No. You'll live. You'll give it to her.
The captain reached out with both hands, the silver chain dangling. His eyes begged, though his cracked lips formed no discernible words. Gideon almost gave in to pity, but the anger was still hot in his face. Stubbornly, he pulled back. The words came clearly in his mind, though he could not get his tongue to speak them.
You got a baby now, more than likely. You owe that woman, and you owe that baby, and you owe us. You going to live if I got to kill you.
Only the anger came out, not the words. Gideon moved away, and the captain seemed to understand that Gideon refused to release him from his responsibilities. Hollander turned his head away in the shadow beneath the blanket. He clutched the silver watch against his chest, his shoulders heaving. In a while, he was somehow on his feet again. He motioned for Gideon to help him lift the delirious lieutenant onto the captain's own horse. Gideon tied the young officer in the saddle. Hollander struck out again, southeastward, his steps slow and deliberate. He was setting a pace, an example. His shoulders had a determined set. Gideon sensed that the captain would not give up again. He might die, but he would not surrender. Stumbling, bringing up the rear so no one could drop out without his knowledge, Gideon moved in a trance. It occurred to him that a couple of pack mules had strayed off on their own. Only two were left. The captain's horse gave up after a long time, going to its knees. Gideon struggled to untie the lieutenant, but could not bring his unresponsive fingers to the task. He cut the rope and tried to ease the officer to the ground. He lacked the strength to hold him. He and the lieutenant fell together in a heap. He dragged himself and the lieutenant away before someone cut the animal's throat. That was the last of the horses. Gideon saw that Hollander was studying the other mule, which had remained riderless. The wish was plain in the officer's eyes, but Gideon saw there a reluctance, too. They were no longer officers and men. They were simply men, all in a desperate situation together. Hollander was uncertain about using the advantage that might save his life. Gideon felt a sudden temptation to take the mule himself. He had the strength to do it. Sergeant Esau Nettles forcibly pushed himself into Gideon's mind. In Nettles' eyes, such a thing would be a dishonor upon Gideon and upon the company.
Leave me be!
In his mind, he could see the sergeant's angry eyes burning like fire, and their heat seemed to touch him and force him back from the mule. Gideon motioned for Hollander to take the mule. Somehow his tongue managed the words.
Ride him, sir.
He had not been willing to give Hollander release to die, but now he offered him release to live. Hollander stared at him with remorseful eyes. With Gideon's help, he got onto the mule's back. He reached down and took up the reins to lead the mule on which the lieutenant had been placed. They moved off into the dusk toward a horizon as barren as the one behind them. But the waning of the day's heat brought a rebirth of strength. Gideon kept bringing his legs forward one short step at a time. Darkness came. He had only the cloudiest notion of time, but somewhere, probably past midnight, he heard a cry from Hollander. Fear clutched at him, fear that Hollander was stricken. Gideon forced his legs to move faster, bringing him up to the mules. He stumbled over an unexpected rut in the prairie, and he went heavily to his hands and knees. Hollander pointed at the ground.
Trail! Trail!
Gideon felt around with his hands in the soft sand, trying to find solid ground to help him push back to his feet. Slowly, he understood what Hollander was trying to say. He had stumbled onto a trail, a rut cut by wagon wheels.
Shafter. Shafter's trail.
Shafter, of course. Colonel Shafter had been all over this country the year before, exploring it in a wetter, more amenable season. These ruts had been cut by his long trail of supply wagons. Lieutenant Judson seemed more dead than alive, responding not at all to Hollander's excitement or to Gideon's. Hollander pointed down the trail.
Double Lakes! Come on!
Gideon felt as if he were being stabbed by 1,000 sharp needles. Strength pumped into his legs. He struggled to his feet and found voice.
Water! Water, boys! Water! The other way!
The men quickened their steps. The mules moved out farther and farther ahead of the men afoot, and after a long time, Gideon thought he heard them strike a trot. It was probably in his mind, for surely they no longer had that much strength.
Unless they smell water.
That was it. The mules knew water lay ahead. His legs moved faster, easier, because now they were moving toward life, not death. It might have been 1 mile or it might have been 5. But suddenly there it was, straight in front of him, the broad, dust-covered expanse of the dry Playa Lake, and the moon shining on water that had seeped into the holes the men had dug in another time that seemed as long ago as slavery. The soldiers who had reached there ahead of him lay on their bellies, their heads half buried in the water. Captain Hollander was walking unsteadily around them, using all his strength to pull some men back, lest they faint and drown themselves.
Not too much. Drink slowly. Drink slowly.
Gideon had no time for reason. He flung himself onto his stomach and dropped his face into the water. The shock was unexpected. He felt his head spinning. He was strangling. Hands grabbed him and dragged him back.
Easy now. Easy.
He tried to scramble to the water again, even as he choked and gagged, but the hands held him.
Slow, damn it, slow.
He lapsed into unconsciousness. When he came out of it, he was hardly able to raise his head. He pulled himself to the edge of the water and scooped it up in his hands. He realized that if he fell unconscious again, it must be on the dry ground, lest he'd drown before anyone could respond. The water still had an alkali bite, but that was no longer a detriment. Gideon had never known water so sweet. He rationed himself, drinking a few sips, waiting, then drinking again, always from his cupped hand. He became aware that some men had slid into the water and were splashing around in it with all the joy of unleashed children. He kept drinking a few swallows at a time. Almost at once, it seemed, his tongue began to shrink. He thought of words, and they began to pass his lips in creditable fashion.
Praise Jesus. Bless the name of Jesus.
There was no guard duty, unless Hollander stood it himself. Occasionally, the thirst came upon Gideon with all its furious insistence, and he drank. When finally he came fully awake, the sun was shining warmly in his face. Gradually, he heard stirrings, men going to the water or from it. He pushed to his knees, blinking in surprise at a bright sun an hour or more high. His eyes focused on Captain Hollander, sitting up and staring back. Hollander's face was haggard, his eyes still sunken, but he was an officer again.
Ledbetter, let's see if you can walk.
It took Gideon a minute to get his legs unwound and properly set beneath him. But finally he was standing, swaying. He took a few steps.
Ledbetter, I need a non-com. I want you to regard yourself as a corporal.
And give orders? I ain't never led nobody. I've been a slave for most of my life.
So was Sergeant Nettles.
I sure ain't no Nettles.
Most of us would still be out there in that hell if it hadn't been for you. Perhaps all of us. Like it or not, you're a corporal.
He dismissed further argument.
And we left some men behind us. I want you to pick a couple or three of the strongest, fill what canteens we have left, and go back. Take a mule.
He pointed his chin at Lieutenant Judson.
The lieutenant will ride the other back to the base camp and bring up wagons and supplies. I'll send a wagon on after you.
Gideon sought out three men he thought had regained strength enough to walk. Almost everything had been discarded along the way, so they had nothing to eat except a little hardtack. The men drank all the water they could comfortably absorb so they would not have to drain the canteens later. Those would be needed for whatever men they found along the trail. Looping the canteens over the mule, he set out walking, his step improving as he went along. The rescue party came in time to a Mississippian named Kersey, lying in yesterday's blown-out tracks. It took a while to revive him, and then he clutched desperately at the canteen, fighting when anyone tried to pull it away for his own good. Gideon asked if he knew who else might be behind him, but the man could only shake his head. He couldn't speak. Gideon left one of his three men with Kersey and went out walking again, northwestward. Before long, his legs began to tremble, and he knew he was approaching his limit. He and the other two looked at each other and reached silent agreement. They dropped to rest, the sun hot upon their backs. By night, they had found just one more man. Gideon had managed to shoot a couple of rabbits, and the men shared those, half-cooked over a small fire before sundown. They smothered the fire and walked on for a time to get away from the glow in case it might attract Indians. All day he had watched the unstable horizon, hoping to see Esau Nettles and Nash and Finley riding toward them. Now and again a distant shape would arise, only to prove itself false as the heat wave shifted and the mirages changed. His hopes ebbed with his strength. Night gave him time to brood about Jimbo. He could visualize Jimbo and the men who had gone with him, following the trail of the lost guide until one by one they fell. Jimbo would have been the last, Gideon fancied, and he probably had not given up hope until he had made the last step that his legs would take. Gideon slept fitfully and dreamed a lot, reliving at times his own agony, seeing at other times Jimbo or Esau Nettles dying alone in that great waste of sand and burned short grass. They moved again in the coolness of dawn, but the men had less hope now to buoy them along. Though no one spoke his doubts, they were clear in every man's eyes. The wagon came as Hollander had promised. The other men stayed behind to leave the load light. Gideon got aboard as guide. The driver and his helper had not been on the dry march. They could only follow the tracks, the trail of abandoned equipment, the swelling bodies of horses that had died one by one along the way. Riding silently on the spring seat as the wagon bounced roughly over dry bunch grass and shinery, Gideon drew into a shell, steeling himself for what he had become convinced he would find at the end of the trip. It was as he had expected, almost. They found little Finley first. To Gideon's amazement, he was still alive. He fought like a wildcat for the canteen Gideon held to his ruined lips. Gideon was unable to keep him from drinking too much at first, and for a while he thought Finley might die from overfilling with the alkali-tainted water. Like a candle flame flickering before it dies, Gideon's hopes revived briefly. Perhaps finding Finley alive was a good omen. The hopes were soon crushed. They found Black Napoleon dead. As an act of mercy, Nettles had taken off the saddle and bridle and turned the horse loose on the chance it could save itself. The gesture came too late. Soon Gideon found Esau Nettles and the young trooper Nash lying beneath a blanket spread for shade over a patch of shin oak. Even before he lifted the blanket, Gideon knew with a shuddering certainty they were dead. He dropped in the sand beside them, drew up his knees, and covered his face in his arms. In the wagon, he could hear little Finley whimpering out of his head. Anger struck at Gideon, sharp, painful, and futile. For a moment, the anger was against Finley, a liar, a sneak thief, a coward. Why should he live when a man like Esau Nettles had died? The anger exhausted itself. Only the sorrow remained, deep and wounding. The trip back to the Double Lakes was slow and silent. Little Finley regained mind enough to be afraid of the two bodies and to move as far from them as possible without climbing out of the wagon.
They're dead. Long relief.
Gideon chose not to dignify the question by answering it. His contempt for Finley sank deeper into his soul. As the wagon went along, it picked up the men who had stayed behind. Most had walked some distance in the direction of the lakes rather than wait to be hauled all the way. All looked in brooding silence at the blanket-covered bodies. Those too exhausted climbed into the wagon beside them. Those who could walk continued to do so. Gideon got down and joined them, for he was feeling stronger. The exertion of walking helped the black mood lift itself from him. Captain Hollander met the wagon as it pulled up to the edge of the lake. Gideon stared, surprised. The captain had shaved and washed out his uniform. It was wrinkled, but passably clean, within the limitations of the jippy water. Army routine had again prevailed over the challenge of the elements. Hollander counted the men who walked and who climbed out of the wagon. He asked no unnecessary questions. He seemed to read the answers in Gideon's face. He lifted the blanket and looked at the bodies, his face tightening with a sadness he did not try to put into words.
We'd better bury them here, in this weather.
The digging was left to men who had come up from the supply camp, for they had the strength. Hollander had brought no Bible to read from, an oversight some might regard as indicative of the reasons for the company's travail. The captain improvised a long prayer, asking God's blessings upon these men, these devoted servants of their country and their Lord, and upon any others like them who had met death alone on that hostile prairie, unseen except by God's own messengers come to lead them to a better land. Toward dusk, Gideon heard a stir and looked where some of the men were pointing, northward. He saw horsemen coming. His first thought was Indians, but soon he could tell these were soldiers. The man in the lead was unmistakable, Jimbo. Jimbo spurred into a long trot and Gideon strode forward to meet him. Jimbo jumped to the ground. In camp, when all the howdies were said and the reunions had lost their initial glow, Jimbo told his tale.
That guide, Jose, missed the Silver Lake he was trying to find, and instead come on this set of springs just off Yellow House Canyon. We ain't stayed in the springs long enough to rest ourselves and the horses. We fill canteens and set out on your back trail to carry water to the column, but we was marching and marching and couldn't find no one. We was afraid maybe all you had died. So we went back to the springs, rested a while, then set out to find Double Lakes in the base camp. Y'all know the rest.
Captain Hollander's face twisted in remorse as he listened. The hunters had been right. If he had followed them, his troops would have reached water sooner than they did. Perhaps Esau Nettles and Private Nash would not be dead. Perhaps others would not still be missing.
You used your best judgment based on the facts at hand, Frank. You knew this water was here. Now, you couldn't know there was water where the hunters wanted to go. They were just guessing. What if they'd been wrong? You had the responsibility for all these men. Those hunters could gamble, and you could not.
Gideon knew Judson was right, as Hollander had been. But he could see the doubt settling into the captain's eyes. As long as Hollander lived, it would be there. The questions coming upon him suddenly in the darkness of a sleepless night, in the midst of his pondering upon other decisions he would be called upon to make in the future. To the end of his life, Hollander would be haunted by Esau Nettles and the others, and by the unanswered question, did it have to be? Gideon looked at him. It was one of the few times in his life he had ever genuinely pitied a white man. Gideon wrestled a while with his doubts, then approached the captain hesitantly.
Sir?
He took off his hat and abused it fearfully in his nervous hands.
Sir, you done right. Old Sergeant, he'd have said so himself, if he could. He'd have said, "You always done right."
Hollander stared at the ground a long time before he looked up at Gideon.
"Thank you, Ledbetter. There's not a man I'd rather hear that from than you. And him."
Late on the afternoon of the sixth day, a column of mounted men and two army ambulances broke through a veil of dust out of the south. A rider loped ahead of the column, pulling up in the edge of camp. He was the civilian scout Pat Maloney from the village of Ben Ficklin. He saw Captain Hollander and Lieutenant Judson standing beside a wagon.
"Woo-ha! Frank Hollander! Damn it, man! We thought you was dead!"
He pumped Hollander's hand excitedly, but that was not enough. The ex-Confederate gripped the Union officer's arms and shook them in a violence of joy.
"I'm gonna tell you the God's honest truth, Frank. We come to hunt for your body. We thought every man jack of you died."
His gaze swept the camp. Gideon felt the scout's eyes stop momentarily on him and Jimbo, lighting with pleasure at the sight of them.
"A few of us are dead. The best of us, perhaps."
Maloney looked around a second time, his face going grim as he missed Nettles.
"The old sergeant?"
Hollander looked at the ground.
"We buried him."
"We thought from what we heard that we'd have to bury y'all."
He explained that Sergeant Waters had somehow made it back to Fort Concho with two others. They had brought a report that Captain Hollander and all his men had been led astray by Indians on that great hostile plain, that they and all those buffalo hunters were dying from heat and thirst.
"Waters was certain that no one except the three of them had survived."
Maloney pointed to the approaching column.
"You can imagine how that news tore up the post at Concho."
Apprehension struck Hollander.
"My wife, Adeline, she heard that."
"Everybody heard it."
"She must be half out of her mind. This and the baby coming. We'll have to send word back right away."
Maloney smiled.
"Hey, you know I got me a brand new baby boy, Frank?"
"That's good, Pat. Glad to hear it."
But his mind was clearly elsewhere.
"Yeah, who knows? He may grow up to marry that little girl your wife had. Join the North and the South together again, so to speak."
Hollander's eyes widened. He had heard that.
"A girl? A girl, you say? You've seen it?"
"Went by there last thing before I left the post. She looks like her mother. Damn lucky thing, too, because her papa looks like hell."
The trip back to Fort Concho was made slowly and carefully, for more men were afoot than on horseback, and none had completely regained strength. At times, even the civilian Maloney would step down from his horse and walk a while, letting some tired black trooper ride. Messengers had carried the news of their approach ahead of them, so that most of the people of St. Angela were lined up to watch the arrival of men who had come back from the dead. An escort and fresh horses were sent out from the post. Hollander and Judson and Maloney rode at the head of the column. Gideon was behind them, urging the men to sit straight and look like soldiers that Esau Nettles would have wanted to claim. Ordinarily, they would not have ridden down the street, but this was an occasion, and the escort wanted to show them off. Lined along Concho Avenue were civilians of all ages, sizes, and colors, white to brown to black. Most cheered the soldiers as they passed, though Gideon looked into some eyes and found there the same hostility he had always seen. Nothing, not even the ordeal the soldiers had been through, had changed that. Nothing ever would. 2/3 of the way down to Oak Street, a seedy, bearded man leaned against a post that held up the narrow porch of a new but already dingy little saloon. He waited until Hollander came abreast of him.
"Say, Captain, why didn't you do us all a favor and leave the rest of them damn niggers out there?"
Hollander tensed. He turned in the saddle, rage bursting into his face. He freed his right foot from the stirrup and started to dismount. Maloney caught his arm.
"Frank, you ain't got your strength back."
Maloney handed his reins to Gideon and walked up to the man with a dry and dangerous smile set like concrete. He crouched, and when his fist came up, it was like a sledge. The man's head snapped back and then his whole body followed. He slid across the little porch, winding up half in and half out of the open front door. Maloney looked first to one side, then the other, challenging one and all. Nobody took up his challenge. He reached down for the struggling man.
Here, friend, let me help you up.
Maloney hit him again, knocking him through the door and into the saloon. With a wink to Gideon, he took his reins back, returned to the saddle, and gave the silent Hollander a nod.
You're welcome.
Sitting on the ground, staring at but not really seeing the autumn yellowing of the trees above the lodges close spaced along the distant creek, Gray Horse listened despondently to the medicine man in the teepee behind him. Shaking a gourd rattle, waving a buffalo tail, comes down from the mountain, was trying to break the fever of Gray Horse's son. The old man had been at it since morning, without making a showing, the Gray Horse could tell. He didn't blame the medicine man. Comes down had power for many things, but he did not have the power to change this miserable place. It was this reservation which had kept the boy from being strong, and that had him struggling now for every breath that entered his body. Summer had been close and oppressive. The wind did not carry away the heat as on the plains. Winter here howled down like an evil old sorcerer who hated all men, and there were not enough canyons and sheltered places to protect all the people from its assault. The white men had promised much to the Comanches if they would be good Indians and stay on the reservation. Gray Horse wore the red flannel shirt they had given him to replace the buckskins, and over it a coat from which he had torn off the sleeves to leave his arms free. The agency-issued trousers were so large that he considered using them to cover a sweat lodge. Most of the time he wore nothing more than his accustomed breechcloth, which flapped below the tails of the altered coat. The hat he had thrown away. The Indian agents had miscalculated. In asking and obtaining appropriations from Congress, the officials had counted on the Indians being able to obtain a substantial part of their meat through supervised hunting of the buffalo. Nobody had foreseen that the vast herds would dissolve before the professional hunters' rifles like snow under a late March sun. An economy-minded government was not interested now in raising the appropriations to make up the shortfall. Because Black Robe had come to the reservation without more than average coercion, the agents wanted to reward him and many of the other peace chiefs with cows. If the Comanches were not to become farmers or sheepmen, the Quakers declared they might be taught to raise cattle. Gray Horse did not qualify because he had not come willingly or early to the reservation, nor had he been an exemplary good Indian since his arrival. In fact, he had avoided incarceration and possibly shipment to a Florida prison at the beginning only by always being elsewhere when the agency people or the soldiers came snooping around. He was a shadowy figure to them, like a wolf, and they were a long time even learning his name so they could enter it on the agency roll. That was the spring and summer Gray Horse and Limping Boy and some of the others had gone back to the Double Mountain and Yellow House country, harassing the buffalo hunters, stealing their stock, leading the buffalo soldiers into the waterless sands of losing them. The agency people had finally taken many of the newly acquired horses and mules away, but they never found Gray Horses. He kept moving them back and forth, staying ahead of the searchers until they grew weary and went back to the comfort of agency headquarters. For all they ever knew, Gray Horse had never left home. Home. This was not home. It never could be. This place where they had set his people down was hardly large enough to sweat a windbroken pony. There was hardly a spot a man could go and not smell the camp smoke of some other band. A short ride in almost any direction brought him up against the Kiowa, the Cheyenne. It was said that even the hated Tonkawas were to be brought to this place, though he doubted the agency people, foolish though they were, would long tolerate their smell. A shadow fell across the ground in front of Gray Horse, and he looked back over his shoulder at the bent form of his uncle father, Black Robe, walking slowly and unsteadily toward him in the rapidly descending autumn sun. He knew from the unevenness of the steps that Black Robe was drunk again. Those of the agency-given cattle which had not been eaten had been traded off for the white man's whiskey. His father tried to squat on his heels, but was unable to maintain his balance. He fell back heavily onto his rump and would have hit his head against the foot-packed ground had Gray Horse not caught him and helped him to right himself. He tried to stretch his legs in front of him, but the pain of arthritis kept them bent at the knees. All the older people complained of arthritis here. It was something else comes down from the mountain had been unable to cure. Now he sat blurry-eyed, aged beyond his years, sick of soul and body. By the look of him, he would go to meet his grandfathers in another winter or two. It was this place that had laid a curse on him. Out on the plains, he would still be healthy for a man of his years. He would be looking forward to many more winters, to teaching his grandchildren how to ride horseback and how to place an arrow where they wanted it to go. Even the young suffered. Black Robe's grandson, the son of Gray Horse, had a fever that grew worse each day, and the foul air of the place they were forced to live did not want to enter his small body. The dark suspicion had grown in Gray Horse for a long time. The white men had put the people in this unhealthy place because they wanted them all to die. They would kill with sickness those they had not killed with the soldiers. In the teepee behind the two men, Comes down from the mountain, blew on a bone whistle, and shook the gourd. Black Robe pondered a while in silence.
I had a good dream last night. I dreamed I crossed back over the rivers with my grandson, and we killed many buffalo. In my dream, I showed him how to use the lance, and he killed many more than I did.
The buffalo are nearly gone, Father. I have seen it all with my own eyes. The Tabo hunters have killed them.
They could not. There are way too many. The buffalo have just gone to hide in a place where the white hunters cannot find them. But we can find them. Our medicine is still good.
Gray Horse let the matter rest. One did not argue with his father, and one could not argue with the man whose judgment was stolen by whiskey. Gray Horse didn't speak of it, but he also had had a dream of late, a recurring one. It always started with the buffalo dream of old, with the red calf alone among the skeletons of its kind. But it did not end there, as it had so often done before. In this dream, a wolf came trotting out of the shadow of the Double Mountains and crossed the prairie among the bones. Now it turned into a set of warriors painted for battle. Into the dream came the soldiers, and the warriors charged at them and killed them all. When the scalps were taken, all the bones rose up and became buffalo again, and the red calf punched its nose eagerly at its mother's udder. As the dream ended, the warriors turned back into the wolf and trotted away through the buffalo, which had grown into as many as they had been before the white man came. He had sat many hours brooding over the dream. It had burned itself deeper into his mind each time it came to him, until he was almost certain it was intended as a vision. But a vision needed a meaning. He had found no meaning. The whistling and the gourd rattling stopped. Comes down from the mountain left the teepee. The old shaman was weary, his eyes downcast.
My medicine is not strong enough here. If we could take him to a place where I have more power.
Gray Horse thought of the medicine mounds, but that was on the forbidden side of the Red River. The soldiers would surely turn them back. If not the soldiers, the rangers. The rangers would have no mercy, not even on a sick little boy. They would kill them all.
I'm going to my sweat lodge. Perhaps when I am clean again, I will have more power.
Gray Horse bowed his head, his hope weak.
He will live, my son. I feel it in my bones. That is not what worries me. But what he will live for, that sits heavily on my mind. What chance does he have to become a man? Really a man? The soldier chief says, we must never fight anymore. There will not be any more war. But how is a boy to become a man? How does he prove his courage except at war? How does he earn honor? Without honor, he had just as well die now. There is no life unless there is honor in it. There is no honor without war. Our boys had just as well be white men.
The old man nodded his fists.
We should never have given up so easily to the soldiers. We could have fought them. There was a time we could have turned them back. No, we are too weak unless the spirits help us. I am afraid we have disappointed the spirits too much. They do not hear their people anymore.
Grey Horse let his father precede him into the lodge, hot and close from the fire comes down had kept going, and the ceremonial water he had sprinkled into it for steam. Green Willow crouched over the bed where the boy lay, her eyes puffed from crying and lack of sleep. She was still a young woman, little past 20 summers, but in her trouble she looked almost middle-aged. The boy wheezed. Grey Horse could feel the heat rising from his small body before he even touched his son with the flat of his hand. Black Robe said nothing. He turned abruptly and went back outside. Grey Horse stared helplessly at the tortured young face until his heart swelled and seemed ready to burst. He turned away, looking at nothing in particular because tears scalded his eyes. He reached out to steady himself. His hand fell upon the round deerskin bag that he had not opened since that last raid into Texas. He had intended to give it to his son someday, that perhaps it might help him gain the power. He unlaced the cover and slipped it off of his old bullhide shield, letting the feathers that rimmed it fall free with the hunter's scalp and the buffalo tail. He looked at the painted wolf tracks and ran the point of his finger along the edge, feeling for the tooth marks left on it that night the great wolf had come to him on the mountain. They were still there, and as he felt them, a tingling began on his skin. He straightened. The tears stopped. In his mind rang an old and demanding call. Without a word to Green Willow, he picked up his blanket and his pipe and a sack of issued tobacco. He hung the shield over his arm. Green Willow watched him, but did not ask. She knew by the signs what he intended to do. He walked to the creek in the dusk and bathed himself thoroughly in its chilling water. Careful not to let the water touch it, he hung his medicine bag around his neck again, picked up the blanket, shield, and pipe, and waded to the other side. He sat awake far into the night, waiting patiently. Thirst wrinkled and dried his lips. Hunger clutched at his stomach. Not until long after the thunder had drawn away did he begin to feel drowsy. He lay down and folded the blanket over him, knowing the spirits would awaken him if they came. He was thinking about the buffalo dream when sleep came. The dream started as always, with the buffalo calf in the red hair of its first months, and the prairie on which the buffalo bones lay scattered. This time he saw more than before. The white hunters passed through the dream, looking for more buffalo to slaughter, and he knew why the bones were there. Then from the west, from the two buffalo hump shapes that were the double mountains, the great wolf came trotting with vengeance in its amber eyes. As Grey Horse watched, the wolf suddenly was not a wolf at all, but a band of warriors, and he himself rode at their head, carrying that wolf-track shield with the mark of the lightning. They overtook and slew the hunters to a man. The soldiers appeared on a hill, and he led the warriors to the attack, waving the shield that once again was invincible to their bullets. The soldiers fell before them like dead leaves before the flood. The warriors took their scalps and shouted the news of their victory. And as in the dreams before, the bones took shape and became buffalo. And the red calf filled its belly while the numbers of buffalo grew and grew until the prairie was black with them. The warriors rode away until only one was left, and that one was Grey Horse. He raised the wolf shield over his head, and he became the great wolf. Then he too turned away, back to his home on the Double Mountains. The meaning of the vision was clear now. The spirits had given Grey Horse back his power, They wanted him to lead warriors out to the plains, kill the hunters, and defeat the soldiers. When that was done, the buffalo would come back, and the people could return to the land that had been theirs, that would always be theirs.
But I cannot go. My son is sick. I cannot leave him.
A clap of thunder sounded like a gunshot in his ears. It brought him suddenly awake. A bolt of lightning flashed and struck somewhere very near him, searing his eyes and blinding him for a minute. He was aware of a chill wind buffeting him, picking at the edges of the blanket, rolling his shield across the hilltop. When he could see, he got to his feet and searched anxiously for the shield. He found it lodged against some cured bunch grass and picked it up quickly before the wind could take it again. The rain began to pound him, but the greatest chill came from within. He gathered his things and descended the hill and crossed the creek. Walking toward his lodge, he heard the wailing of women, and he knew what awaited him before he stepped through the opening. His heart sank, heavy and cold. He let the half-soaked blanket fall to the ground. Black Robe stood with his back turned, bracing himself against a lodge pole. Gray Horse's mother and sisters huddled together, crying. Green Willow was on her knees beside the little bed. Her black hair had been hacked short, and handfuls lay scattered before her. She had cut away the top of her deerskin dress. As Gray Horse watched, she dug the point of the knife deeply into the skin and cut a swiftly widening red line across her breastbone, then across both breasts. She jabbed the blade into her arm and slashed. He raised the buffalo shield to his chest and lowered his head to rest against its rim, hiding the anguish in his face. The spirits had known. They had set him a task, and they had known he would be free to go. Sergeant Gideon Ledbetter hunched over a bare wooden table in the silent company mess and laboriously scrawled troopers' names on the daily report. A flickering oil lamp made the words dance. He wondered if Captain Hollander would be able to read them. Writing had been the hardest part of the continuing lessons Gideon had taken from the post-chaplain. Reading had come easier. Though he still stumbled over some of the long words, he could handle newspapers reasonably well now, when he could lay his hands on one. The captain frequently left books or magazines he thought Gideon should read. There were times when he almost wished he had not learned, for often he came across articles that troubled him. He knew agitation had been raised in Washington to disband all four black regiments and declare the whole concept of the Negro soldier a failure. On the other hand, he knew that a young Negro named Henry O. Flipper had been graduated from West Point, the first Army officer of his race. Gideon had read part of the Flipper account aloud to the company. Jimbo had scoffed at the notion. Jimbo didn't believe enough things really happened in the whole world to fill a newspaper. He was convinced somebody just made up most of that stuff. Though Jimbo refused to accept the news about Flipper, he was willing to believe every dark rumor that drifted his way about the future of the 10th and of the fort. Rumors gathered to Jimbo as animals gathered to salt. Gideon did not want to believe the Army would seriously consider disbanding the black regiments. He knew their campaign record was substantial, on a par with most white units stationed in the West. He knew their desertion rate averaged the lowest in the Army. Not enough black soldiers left the frontier posts even to give the quartermasters a chance to explain away their shortages. The old stiffness between Gideon and Hollander had largely dissolved after that disaster on the plains, their 86 hours without water and the fury of a July sun. Each had taken the measure of the other and was satisfied. Their manner remained proper and respectful, as befitted military protocol, but beyond it had grown a degree of mutual trust, like the one Gideon had sensed between Hollander and Esau Nettles. Each man had tested his limits in the presence of the other and had managed to reach beyond them. Nettles. The old sergeant tracked relentlessly through Gideon's mind, appearing unbidden, unexpected, at odd moments when Gideon was called upon to exercise leadership.
Take care of him, soldier.
Nettles stood in silent judgment, like some tall measuring post, and Gideon always found himself looking up. He wore nettle stripes now, but he doubted he could ever stretch himself quite as tall. At times, overreached by Nettles' remembered shadow, he felt almost like an imposter. Hearing footsteps at the door, he looked up over the report. Captain Hollander walked into the mess room carrying his red-haired little daughter on his hip. Gideon stood up quickly. The captain set the girl's feet on the rough wooden floor.
At ease, Sergeant. I trust you have the coffee hot?
Hollander kept a marked cup in the company mess for those evenings when his auburn-haired wife entertained other ladies of the post and had no comfortable place to shelve her husband out of sight and mind. Hollander was not one to frequent the sutlers much, and even less to while away his evenings risking life and fortune over the river in St. Angela. The girl toddled toward Gideon on bowed legs. Grinning broadly, he reached out to catch her in case she stumbled. Some officers' wives considered it disgraceful that Hollander allowed black hands to touch his little daughter. Hollander always told them to mind their own business, politely, of course, and in better chosen words. Gideon played patty cake with the girl while he worked up the nerve to ask the question.
Captain, they really gonna bust up this regiment?
You've been listening to the sink house rumors again. Rumors will worry you into an old man ahead of your time.
But, sir, you reckon they'd really turn us out on the road?
It was an old and deep fear, born of the time he had been put off of the plantation.
The tent is safe, Sergeant. You can sleep well tonight. Colonel Grierson has it on good authority from departmental headquarters.
Glad to hear that, sir. I've about come to like it here.
The captain shook his head.
I didn't say we'd be staying here. The Apaches are still on the prowl out west. People are crying for help. The colonel has orders to move part of the regiment past the Pecos, out to Fort Davis in the mountains.
The captain sensed an unspoken question.
We'll be moving, but not just yet. There's word the Comanches, some of them, have bolted the reservation. If someone else doesn't find them, we may have to.
Comanches? I thought we jugged and stoppered them people for good.
Not all of them.
Gideon had not thought of Big Dempsey in a long time. Suddenly, the angry soldier was stamping through his brain.
We drove them people off of their homeland. We put them in a place where they didn't want to be. I reckon it's in every man to want to go back home.
The captain half closed his eyes, hiding his feelings.
You ever want to go back home, Sergeant?
Army's all the home I got anymore, sir. Lately, I've been worrying I might lose it. Reckon that's why I know the way them Indians must be feeling. Makes me kind of wonder if we done right.
We did our duty. The soldier does his duty and tries not to think about it.
Hard not to think about it sometimes.
The captain frowned over the strong coffee.
We did what we were sent here to do. We made the land safe for civilized people.
Gideon shook his head.
Then people out west? They want us now. You reckon they'll still want us after we've penned up their Apaches?
He answered his own question, tightening the hand into a fist.
When it's all over, the Indian will still be red, and I'll still be black. But the land will be white.
And you'll still be a soldier.
Gideon thought back uneasily to Esau Nettles, knowing Nettles would not have let himself be troubled by such doubts.
Not as good a one as I ought to be.
Gid! Where you at?
Trooper Lonnie Bowes trotted through the doorway into the mess, saw the captain, and halted, bringing himself to attention and raising his hand in salute.
At ease.
Gideon wished the captain hadn't heard the casual use of his given name. No enlisted man ever called Nettles Esau.
What you need, Bowes?
Lonnie pointed excitedly.
You better quick march over the river, Gid. Jimbo's fixing to get into trouble with a buffalo hunter.
Gideon grimaced. It wasn't even payday. What was Jimbo doing messing around in St. Angela? He probably didn't have $3 between himself and bankruptcy.
I better go see, sir.
Hollander's eyes showed concern. Two of his troopers had been murdered on the north bank of the river within the last 6 months.
If you wait till I get Melissa home, I'll go with you.
May not be time for waiting.
I better go see, sir.
He saluted, patted the girl on the head, and followed Bowes out of the barracks. He saw 100 points of lamp and lantern light across the river and felt an old hatred.